Can you guys hear me? Yes. Okay, I'm mic'd. Hi, everybody. My name is Tracy Laney, and I am the Chief Human Resource Officer for Shutterfly, a proud sponsor of this conference. I'm really excited to be here today, specifically just kicking off this topic, which I think is very, very important. So if you're in the place you want to be, you should be in the building trust and navigating the workplace after Me Too, which I think is a critically, critically important topic that's in a lot of our minds as we navigate this current era. And we have an amazing panel to share their insights with us today, so we're very excited about that. So Rachel Thomas is actually going to be our moderator. Rachel is the co-founder and president of the Sheryl Sandberg and Dave Goldberg Family Foundation, which is the nonprofit behind leanin.org. Under Thomas's leadership, the foundation supports a community of more than 2 million women and men in 150 countries that runs public awareness and education programs that reach millions of people a year. And so she's going to moderate what will be a great discussion. I heard there was a subset of this group yesterday at the Workplace Summit, and it was a fascinating conversation. And based upon that, we're actually going to change the format a little bit and start with some insights from the panel, but then really turn it over to you guys for questions. So definitely think about questions. There's microphones around the room, and we'll dive into that pretty early. So thanks for being here. I'll come back at the end and just give a little bit of housekeeping. A couple of our panelists have books they'll be signing, so I'll share that if you're curious to learn more. And I'm going to turn it over to Rachel now, who will actually ask the panel to introduce themselves and the work that they do. So join me in welcoming you.
Let me go ahead.
Yes, great.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Dave Smith. I am a professor of sociology at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm also the co-author of Athena Rising, How and Why Men Should Mentor Women, with my co-author Brad Johnson, who's unfortunately at a mentoring panel that's going on at the same time.
Hi, everyone. I'm Amy Gallo. I'm a contributing editor at Harvard Business Review, and I'm the author of The HBR Guide to Dealing with Conflict.
Hi, I'm Wendy Pfeiffer, and I am the Chief Information Officer at Nutanix. I travel everywhere with my entourage.
Can I borrow that?
Yes. I have the distinction of having been a leader in technology in Silicon Valley for the last 20 years or so. So I'm one of those people who's survived.
So before we kick things off, and we are going to do more of a Q&A format so that we're having a conversation with you as opposed to talking at you, I do want to set the stage with some of our Lean In research. And I'm going to throw a lot at you at once. I see a lot of women's faces in the room, so you will probably be nodding vigorously as I walk through the research. But I think it's important as a level set. So every year we conduct the Women in the Workplace study with McKinsey & Company. It's the largest study of its kind conducted in the United States. And it says all the things you know. It says that women are underrepresented, women get less, are promoted more slowly, get less support from managers, less access to senior leaders, and it's far worse for women of color, and particularly acute for black women. But the other thing the research shows is that women are having a less than ideal, far less than ideal experience in the workplace. So we know from our research that 2/3 of women experience microaggressions. So that's everyday discrimination. And all of you in the room who are women, you know what this is, and you know what it feels like. This is when you're spoken over in meetings, when you're mistaken for someone more junior, when you have to prove your competence over and over again. And lesbian women in particular experience microaggressions. 3/4 of lesbian women experience them, and it's most often they hear demeaning remarks about themselves or other members of the LGBT community. So that's the first piece. We also looked at sexual harassment, and there's been and should continue to be such a strong focus on sexual harassment in the workplace because one woman being harassed is one too many. In our research, 35% of women have been sexually harassed, and remember, that's corporate America, so that is the tip of the iceberg. We know from other research that we don't do that 9 in 10, for example, women in construction and 9 in 10 women in the restaurant industry are sexually harassed. The other finding that I think we should all just sit and pause on for a moment is 60% of employees, and that's employees of all genders, do not think that a sexual harassment claim in their company would be fairly addressed. So we should all sit with that. The other thing we looked at this past year was the experience of being what we call an only. So this is when you are the only or one of the only women in the room. And the experience onlys are having is markedly worse than the experience women are having who work more regularly with other women. We know onlys are more likely to experience microaggressions. Onlys are 2 times more likely to be sexually harassed. We know they feel far more left out, on guard, under pressure to perform, and it probably doesn't surprise you that onlys are 1.5 times more likely than women who work with other women to think about leaving their company, because they're having a markedly worse experience. The other thing that we did this past year with our friends at SurveyMonkey is we did a study that looked at how people are feeling in the wake of Me Too. And one of the really chagrining findings there, and I know that Dave is going to talk about this, but 50% of managers who are men, about 50%, are uncomfortable with everyday work experiences with women. So that's meeting one-on-one, that's mentoring women. We also found that senior leaders who are men are 5 times more reluctant to invite a junior woman on a business trip, and 3.5 times more reluctant to invite a junior woman to dinner than they would be a junior man. So all of these findings, I think, are a good foundation for the conversation today so that we understand everybody in this room cares deeply about getting to inclusive, respectful, supportive workplaces. So now the conversation is, how do we do that? And what I'd like everybody on the panel to do is share kind of their biggest piece of wisdom based on the research they've done and the work that they've done on what we can do to move the dial. And some of their practical advice to kick things off. And then what, as I said earlier, what we're hoping to really is have a conversation with you and answer your questions.
Thanks. Thanks for setting us up with all that great information. And again, the work that Lean In's doing and the report from McKinsey is just such great research and help in understanding what we're dealing with. You know, it's interesting. We've heard, I think, in the media, people, senior men say, wow, this is just a really scary time for men in America and, you know, and boys in America. I would push back on that pretty strongly, and I would say, you know, unless you're a serial harasser in the workplace or a perpetrator of assault in the workplace, I don't think you got much to worry about. And to have this kind of a straightforward conversation with men today in the workplace that if that's not who you are, then the answer to this is not to avoid and not to isolate and not to segregate in the workplace. It's that we actually need the opposite. We need more interaction. We've got to work more closely, and in particular for men, start to break down some of those walls and to have more of the cross-sex friendships, the trusted female colleagues in the workplace, to have more of the mentoring relationships in the workplace. We were doing our work around Athena Rising even before the whole Me Too movement really gained a lot of traction. We found a host of reasons why men were what we would call reluctant. There were so many of them, we called it the reluctant male syndrome, about why guys got kind of anxious about having these close relationships in the workplace. And, you know, in understanding what that is and why we might feel that way, I think is part of helping to understand and to break down some of that so that we can begin to change the workplace. One other thing I would just like to mention, because we're talking about Me Too, and for the men in particular, that I think we have to recognize that this is about our female colleagues, our partners in the workplace, our peers, and the people that we count on to get the job done. And this is about them having a voice and speaking truth and being able to have the people that have perpetrated these things against them to be held accountable. And that we should be there speaking up and holding up their voices and making sure that the first thing that comes out of our mouth is that I believe her and that I support making changes in the workplace to make sure that reporting is done properly and that it's believed and that it's handled in appropriate ways. And that this is something where, as men, we need to have more voice. We need to be interacting and have more voice in this conversation and not less. And the last thing I would leave you with is that as men, we talked about this at length yesterday in our keynote, but today maybe we can tie this in here a little bit too, that one of the ways we can think about this, one is mentoring, yes, but more broadly, we can be allies for each other. And this is how we're going to disrupt the status quo and change the more systemic challenges we have in the workplace, is by disrupting that and being allies and working together for each other. So thanks for
Hi. So I want to tell you a story about picking up my daughter from school. This is not a Me Too story, but there's a group of working moms who I sometimes see at pickup, and we always ask, how are you? And the answer is usually overwhelmed, busy, drowning, right? And this one woman said, I asked her how she was doing. She said, oh, overwhelmed. And I said, yeah. And she said, but you know what? We're shifting to the matriarchy right now, so it's going to be chaotic for a while. And I was like, this is a refreshing pickup conversation. Let's continue to discuss this. And I say that because what Dave is talking about in terms of having allies, having these conversations, men standing up, women using their voice in ways that they haven't been allowed to or permitted before, is going to be uncomfortable. And as someone who writes about how to have difficult conversations, I cannot express enough how important it is you be ready to be uncomfortable. And as Brené Brown just so eloquently said, discomfort and the willingness to avoid a conversation because you're uncomfortable is a privilege. And it is a privilege you can no longer exercise, because if we are going to make change in our workplaces, in our society, we have to be uncomfortable. And we can talk more, certainly answer your questions about how do you do that. But that's my big piece of advice, is that this is not going to be easy, folks. And that's okay. So how do we enter these conversations in a way that keeps our own integrity, our own self intact, but also does that for the people that we're talking with?
That's so powerful. Thank you. I'll start with a brief commercial. I have been stunned at this stage in my life to be asked for my advice. How have you done this? What do you think? Just like we started out in this panel. And I'm also on the board of an organization called Girls in Tech. And in the bag that all of you got, there is a sticky note pad. And in that pad, it allows you to write down your very best advice to other women or girls. For every one of these that you put on the wall at the booth at Nutanix, we'll make a donation to Girls in Tech to help women all over the world get access to technical education. So forgive the commercial, but I wanted to tie that into the advice that we're giving, and it's a really important cause. Secondly, I want to talk a little bit about emotion. The Me Too movement was born out of anger and frustration and shame. And I almost can viscerally feel that anger from my own life and my own career experiences. Every time that I even say the phrase, use the hashtag, Me Too is about solidarity with other women who have been hurt and shamed and taken advantage of. So we mustn't lose that, because that's part of what fuels us. However, to thrive in the workplace, those of us who have had our own Me Too moments, I believe we need to show grace. We need to be gracious. If the point of Me Too is to crush the daylights out of all men and wipe them off the planet, I think that's not a great end game. No, the purpose.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're
the purpose.
That's why we brought you here, yeah. Dave.
The purpose is to drive change. And change doesn't happen without acknowledging the problem, but then, most importantly, offering grace, showing forgiveness, saying, I'm talking about this because I believe that men can change. I believe that that particular person who hurt me could change and maybe wants to change if only he knew. And so I think if we are going to be successful going forward in the workplace, then there is some talking and some exposing that needs to happen, but then there's a bringing together of all of us around a platform of grace, saying maybe what you did means that you're not deserving of my friendship, my collaboration, my camaraderie, but for us to succeed going forward, I need to give you that gift. And so it's both things together. And that's really the best advice I have, is try to understand your own propensity for being gracious, full of grace. And if your propensity is poor, then actively work on that. That will help you to succeed.
I think, and that's, I appreciate that point. And I think it's also important to remember that all of the studies about bias toward women are not studies of men. Well, not all of them. Mm-hmm. Most of them are not studies of men bias against women. It's men and women's bias mm-hmm. against women. And so we also are part of the problem. And that is part of the grace, is that we own our own biases against fellow women. And we have to work to overcome those. I know that Rachel has done a lot of research that shows that women contribute to perpetuating these biases.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I didn't say it as I went through the data, which I did yesterday, but you know, when you talk about women experiencing everyday discrimination, also called microaggressions in the workplace, it's really important to be clear that that's from people of all genders. That's not just from men. And you know, sexual harassment, as I said, you know, one woman is one too many. But the day-to-day microaggressions that women experience and kind of the day-to-day systemic barriers that women experience are incredibly fatiguing. And we are all doing that in the workplace, to women and actually to people of color and members of the LGBT community, people who have different beliefs than we do. You know, bias is very pervasive, so and we all fall into bias pitfalls. So I think that is an important part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. I think when you just talk specifically about Me Too, you sometimes fall into the trap of women v. men. Mm-hmm. And when you talk more broadly about what's happening in the workplace and the experiences of people in the workplace, then you're talking about everybody. Right. So we would love to open it up for questions.
Hi. So good to have all of you here. So I've been working on gender partnership for about 15 years. In corporations primarily. And one of the awakenings I had about privilege came when I was standing in line in Cancun on vacation in the United Executive Premier line, which was four people versus the other line that wrapped around the building. And I started thinking about how attached I was to my privilege and the power of being able to be in that line. So I started talking to men about power. And Dave, I'm particularly interested in, do men talk to other men about the what it requires to share power and the confront that that is, especially when you've grown up your whole life with that kind of privilege? I just wonder if you found men can talk about that with each other or if it doesn't necessarily get addressed.
That's a great question. And I think the short answer is no, it doesn't normally happen. I think we can get into spaces where, again, we can have these conversations, but back to the, we've got to begin to get comfortable being uncomfortable, right? And so that means we're going to enter into a space and a conversation that's going to make us uncomfortable because we're going to talk about something that we don't think about because it is privilege, right? And so I don't see my privilege normally. And it, you know, yesterday I talked about the concept, the metaphor. There's been some research done about talking about privilege in a different way, about kind of headwinds and tailwinds. And so we see, you know, again, this is why it's so hard for people to acknowledge whatever privilege you have, and we all have it to some extent, that the headwinds are those obstacles and barriers that we have to overcome, the challenges that we all know, right? You've all got a story or many stories about all the obstacles, the hard work, the dedication, whatever it took to overcome that. And we remember that, right? Because we spent so much effort and time thinking about it. But the tailwinds, right, the things that are pushing us along that we didn't necessarily earn, we were just born that way, we were born into that position, it just came, we don't think about those because they're pushing us along and it doesn't require any mental effort or energy to think about that. So it takes some sort of a disruption of an educational, it could be an educational setting. I personally think it takes something more experiential, an experience to come to grips with, just like you said, right, and standing in a privileged line like that, that you look back, it's like, wow, I guess I do have a little different privilege. It's hard to get into these conversations sometimes with men in particular. I talk about it, I don't even use the P word, because there's so much negative connotation, it's so loaded, and it tends to be, again, aligned with white male privilege also, which makes it even doubly worse for men to talk about. But it's just that much more important that we do understand that we have it, and then what we can do with it. And I think that's the important part as you talk about gender partnership, and I know you probably do this, that once you can recognize that you have it and what that power is, that you can use it for good. Right, we can change, we can disrupt the status quo, we can change all these systemic cultural issues we have in the workplace and really transform it so that, again, we can do all the great things that we know we're capable of that we're just not getting to right now.
Thank you.
The one thing I would say is in our research, we know that when you ask people what their personal commitment to gender diversity and then diversity efforts more broadly, probably not surprising to a lot of you in the room, women of color are the most personally committed. Women are the next most personally committed, then men of color, and then white men. And I don't share that to beat up on white men. I think that actually we need to have a little empathy as well, which is the reason for that is most likely if you're not having the experience yourself, it is much harder to understand it and to kind of be committed to change. So I think one of the things that we need white men to do is start to kind of identify that they're having a different experience. And then I think what we can do, all of us in the room, is talk more openly about the experiences of women and the experiences of people of color, and so that we're educating kind of everybody in the organization. And so there's just a better understanding of what those day-to-day experiences feel like, look like, what the barriers are, because a lot of times they're just not as well, excuse me, there's not as much awareness. Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Hello. So I'm in the room with executives, CEOs, et cetera, who after company meetings will do a debrief and we'll talk about maybe that military example wasn't so great or that quote from Mike Tyson was probably ill-timed. And responses I get are people just need to get over it. You have to be a saint to say anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And they're shying away from their opportunity and responsibility, in my opinion. So I would love some advice on how to coach executives to have them feel more confident and to be able to have them understand the power of language and the difference between intent and impact, because they often said, well, the Mike Tyson thing, it that wasn't my intent. And they think that that's the end of the story. Thanks.
I have a response. I often am the only female in the C-suite, and often I'm in debrief conversations like that. It is scary to be the leader and to speak, and hearing negative feedback afterwards, it's very hard to take that on board. I think a more powerful thing to do is to teach senior executives, leaders, people in positions to influence others about their powerful choices before they speak. So there are powerful examples. There are ways to get the hearts and minds of their entire workforce, men and women. And so it's teaching them about powerful words and sort of that chess game that is corporate leadership, communication. There's a lot of power brokering that goes on in every conversation that we have. And so if we feel that, we're being asked to give away some of our power by being open and inclusive and so on, it's scary. But if we feel that there are powerful examples, words, stories that we can tell, that by being inclusive, we can also encourage our teams, we can get improve our own personal power. That's actually what we want to listen to. So I'm being incredibly honest. Life isn't fair, and senior executive leadership isn't fair either. It's a dogfight continuously. So helping us to understand how to connect to different sources of power that cause people, men and women, to care about us, follow us, admire us. We need that kind of coaching in advance. Afterwards, it's raw. It's really uncomfortable.
The other thing I would say in the debrief as well, because sometimes even when you do that, people are going to say things, and you do want to raise it. I think it's important to raise it, but no one wants to be told they're sexist, racist, homophobic. And if you tell someone that, if you told me that, I would get defensive, right? I would probably tell you that the person who heard that was wrong, because that's a natural reaction to being told that we're discriminating. So instead of framing it that way, not that that's what you're doing, but right, saying... engaging them in a conversation about it. So when I heard you use the Mike Tyson example, this is what came to mind. I know that wasn't your intention. Are there other examples you might be able to use? Right? So you're proactively getting them to think through other things. I think also saying, I know that wasn't your intention, is a real nice way to decharge the conversation. And I love Wendy's suggestion that the other thing is, if you're in conversations with these executives and they tell you an example involving their daughter, they tell you a story that you do think would be useful, like, you know, I think that story would be great. Next time you give that speech, what if we switch that out instead of the Mike Tyson story, right? And again, as if the key in these difficult conversations is to make sure that the person feels you're on their side. Because when they get their hackles up is when they're going to just push it down. And I'm not saying that they're not that going to get their hackles up, even if you do it that way, but you have a better chance if you make them feel like you're on the same side of the table.
Can I take that one? So, so here's some. I always like to come at this when we're engaging men in particular, and I think this is useful again for the women in the room to understand this too. But I think the research is very clear that it helps, right? It makes it. It's different when men confront other men, right? It's absolutely different. They're both important, right? The confrontation or the calling it out, the just disrupting, if they don't even see it, is important no matter who does it. But it's more meaningful if it comes from another man, right? Because if I call it out, if we did some fun role plays yesterday with this. If I call it out, it's not self-interested for me to call out sexism, right? Because I'm not part of that group, even though it does offend me too, by the way. But if I call it out, you know, I don't get the backlash. I don't have to worry about any sort of penalty for calling it out. Even though guys do talk about the fact that there could be penalties with it, we don't find that. And actually, in the research, that there is this penalty in calling out in a confrontation in particular. So, and the other thing is, if you do it publicly, and again, there's always a little bit of sensitivity here as to whether you do this in public or whether you do it in private, and it matters in the context and the situation. But there are some benefits to doing it in public because, again, especially if I'm in a group of just men, and I'm a guy who calls it out, right? That matters tremendously with the other group of men in the room, because we have this notion that we all believe that every other guy in the room has a really high level of acceptance of sexism, which prevents us from stepping up and saying something. But the reality is that we all don't have that. A lot of us have a much lower threshold of acceptance, and it really does offend us in some way. But we don't speak out because we think that everybody has this high level of acceptance, right? So it matters. You disrupt the status quo the minute one guy just says something about it. It doesn't have to be really confrontational or negative. They can just say something about it. The other thing is, if there's women in the room in the situation, that it also helps to break some of the internalizing of stereotypes that again, you all know that you face if you understand the stereotypes, the fact that there's a certain amount of self-shame and blame that you might have brought this upon yourself, And it gives you the confidence to say something next time because, hey, this wasn't about me. This is about his sexist comment, right? This is about the larger group. It wasn't about me personally. So there's a lot of great benefits to actually standing up. And the last thing is it tells guys that we have skin in the game, that we have, hey, it's not the who am I to say something. It's that, no, you know, from a psychological standing, I'm invested in this, and I do, and I should, and I'm accountable, especially if I'm a senior leader, to doing something.
Yeah, and that's where the role of allies, I mean, if you can find someone who can speak up, ideally a man, to Dave's point, who can say, oh, I don't think she was being oversensitive, I heard it that way too, right? Something really neutral. And you can even have another woman say that, right? Like, oh, I didn't hear it that way. I heard, you know, and if you don't have that ally into the room, the issue, you don't want to get into a debate about whether you're being oversensitive or not. That's sort of like a dodging of the issue, right? So you can grant them their premise. This is a great communication tactic, like, okay, I can see how you can think that. What I'm concerned is that other people in the room heard it that way too, right? Or you can say, maybe I have been oversensitive in the past. I don't think that's what's going on here. But I see your point. Let's talk about how we could change it next time, right? Like, just making sure that you're not getting into a debate about who's more sensitive or who's being politically correct, because that's not the point.
At the risk of offending you, though, ask yourself quickly, am I being overly sensitive in this situation? And a great test is this the only feedback that I have given ever? Do I give a range of feedback? Am I talking about the quality of the examples, the quality of the data, the overall strategy that's being delivered, their grammar, or am I only ever speaking up about this issue? If I'm only ever speaking up about this issue, then it is actually logical for the feedback to be, well, this is the thing that you are sensitive about. You're not engaging in the rest of the corporate dialogue. So I would just say, and if you ask yourself, and this isn't the only thing, but this is just one thing, then you're cool. Throw their feedback away and move on. But I would encourage you to just actually do a check.
And if you know the person well, you can even joke. You can say, oh, come on, I give you feedback about all sorts of things. This is equally important, right?
Yeah. Sorry.
Hi. So I'm Jacqueline, and I've had a couple of people that I've talked to since the advent of the Me Too movement, primarily men, who I think one thing that's been confusing is sort of drawing lines. Like someone said to me, like, oh, like, someone got mad because a male colleague commented on her haircut or something. And it's like, for me, I think of it all about context, but I'm trying to figure out how to articulate that in a way that makes sense to, like, any man that I'm talking to in a pretty succinct way. Like, yeah, okay, like, if we're really good friends and you talk about my haircut, like, okay, cool. But if you're, like, a much more senior man who I don't know, who says, like, that's kind of, you know, it's just all about context. So I don't know, just advice for how to articulate that succinctly and clearly would be helpful.
I just said this to a senior leader at another company, not Nutanix. If you're saying it to me in order to possibly get laid, I can tell.
That is a good litmus. Yeah. The other thing I'd recommend, there's Kathleen Reardon is a professor. She wrote a piece. There's a piece on hbr.org about navigating the gray areas. And she has a spectrum of sexual misconduct from not offensive at all to blatantly illegal. And I think that's a helpful thing to refer to say to people, right, this behavior falls on a spectrum. A lot of it is about context. A lot about your intention. I would worry less about your being policed and worry more about what your intention is, to Dave's point earlier. It's Kathleen Reardon is her name, Reardon.
The other tool you might want to look at really quickly, just as we're talking about respectful and inclusive environments, is so we do case studies in our Women in the Workplace study every year. And this past year we did one on Mozilla. And actually they have articulated What I like about this is a lot of organizations and managers spend time articulating what's not acceptable. And I want to be really clear, Mozilla's done that. But they've actually gone further and they've articulated what good behavior and respectful and inclusive behavior looks like. And they've been very specific. And so they have a set of guidelines that you can look at where they talk about what isn't acceptable and what is, and then what the ramifications of the behavior is. But what I like is being able to point people to somewhere which is written out really clearly. They make it publicly available. But again, this idea of not just what's not right, but what does. Mm-hmm. What does, where are we all going? What does a successful organization look like? So checking out their guidelines might be something that's a helpful tool as well, just as you're talking to people. It's a Mozilla, and it's not a study. They actually have guidelines, kind of rules of engagement for the organization, and have set to set the right culture. So you can look those up. If you just Google, they'll come right up. Yeah.
Can I go?
Yep. Great.
I have three quick things. One is an appreciation. The second one is a clarification. And the third is my question.
Sure.
The appreciation is for recognizing and raising the topic. When a man, a white man, is confronted with asking for, you know, come on, help us solve this problem, I think we need to recognize and appreciate when you're asking someone to give up power that they've had and never really known about. It's an adjustment. And it's a lot to ask. None of us willingly want to go give up our power that we have. And so I think, and we're really talking about a power dynamic in many ways. So I just want us to appreciate and own that as recognizing the difficulty. My clarification is I'm a bit concerned that with the topic of this panel, when we're talking about life after Me Too, that we not conflate unconscious bias against women with sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing. And so while I appreciate the comment about grace when it comes to unconscious bias, when it comes to sexual harassment, I don't think grace is the first thing I would go for. Mm-hmm. So I just want to clarify that as we're talking, maybe we can try to differentiate a little bit. The issues are quite different in my mind anyway, in my experience. So the third thing is
Can I just step in before you ask?
Sure.
Before you, because I do,
yeah, yeah.
I think that is an important point. Mm-hmm. I also think that the systemic bias against women is what has, and preventing women from getting higher in organizations is what created this environment that
sure.
allowed sexual harassment. So it's a very, the
for
distinction
sure.
is important, and yet it's very complex.
But when you have so many women that have suffered sexual harassment, it hasn't been acknowledged, and there hasn't been any kind of restitution or systemic change. I think it's a lot to ask to come forward with grace first. I think first we want to see, now I'm not speaking for everyone, but I think it's a point of great sensitivity in the conversations I've had with leaders and executives. I hear it a lot that, you know, I'm happy to be part of the solution, but I would like someone to first acknowledge that this is actually a real and serious problem. And we see examples all around us that there is not accountability being publicly held in some very, very public situations. And that
yeah.
really is what has to do with the Me Too movement, I think. While the purpose of it was to come together for solidarity and it might have been driven by anger, I think the other thing is to make a clear picture of how pervasive this situation mm-hmm. is in ways that maybe a woman would never have said if there hadn't been that kind of less, slightly more anonymous way to do it.
You
I don't know if you agree.
I, as the person who used the term grace, first of all, absolutely acknowledge what you're saying and, you know, the fact that now we're in a moment in time where women in particular in this Me Too movement are able to speak out about, you know, some pretty horrific things that happen to them, whether they be, you know, sexual harassment or even worse. That is incredibly powerful, and I am not advocating that we ignore that or we end our anger around that. In fact, just the opposite, that's a building power in society.
Wendy, that was your intention.
Yeah, yeah,
I just wanted to
yeah.
clarify it because
I
find the conflation is really easy.
Sure.
And the issues span such a broad range. So it's a terrific conversation. And by
it is. It is.
No but, offense intended.
But I'm going to come back around to my other point, though. Even then, even with how terrible these acts have been, even in my own career, the title of this panel is How Do We Move Forward? Yeah. And unfortunately, because of the systemic nature of not just unconscious bias, but this layer of privilege, this pandemic of sexual violence and sexual harassment, we sort of find ourselves polarized. I've been thinking about this lately. Quick story, I fell down and crushed my wrist and had to have a bunch of stuff rebuilt. And in the process of rebuilding, it started getting worse. And what had happened is I started developing intense scar tissue. Mm-hmm. And what scar tissue is it's your body's way of healing and reducing pain in the area at first. But if it goes too far, if the scar tissue begins to protect, especially in my case, the nerve bundle too much, mm-hmm. the healing stops and it goes in the opposite direction. Yeah. If ultimately our goal is to be healthy in our society, in our corporations, et cetera, then once that crime and that heinousness is acknowledged, again, unless we're going to segregate the 60% of men in society that may have engaged in some level of this, if we're not going to do that, then we have to somehow find a place of grace.
For sure. Because but I think it's just a timing issue.
I agree with you. So that's first one, then the other. Totally agree.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the one thing I think you're saying, which I couldn't agree with more, and I think we all feel in the room, is I think a lot of what we're trying to talk about today on the panel is not, it's actually not harassing us is not enough. Which is,
that's great.
It's a pretty low bar.
Right, that's a very low bar. Yeah. So what I think trying to switch to is a lot of this is rooted in power and unconscious bias and systemic barriers. And so I think what I hope you're hearing from everybody on the panel is not harassing us is not enough.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And now we're talking about how to move the dial and create workplaces that are actually safe and inclusive and respectful.
This is perfect. So at the risk of slightly going back to the data side, I teach graduate students at a well-known West Coast business school, and we recently got into a conversation with a group of students about, so they're all like late 20s pretty much, and I'm sure we have some age compatriots in the room, and I was a little bit shocked personally to hear the responses of some of the young women saying, you know, women should just get over this, like, let's just move on, like, why do people need to complain about it? I guess I was a little bit surprised, so I'm kind of curious about what you've seen across age cohorts in the data. Are attitudes somehow different?
So we have not seen anything in our data that would lead you to believe that young women are any less deeply committed to change. And we see some encouraging data around young men being more woke and kind of more Definitely. Aware and more committed to equality. I mean, the one thing I will tell you anecdotally that we see a little bit, which is interesting, so we run what are called lean-in circles. These are small groups of usually... these are small groups of women who gather together on a regular basis. And what we've noticed is that oftentimes younger women, it doesn't really resonate with them quite as much because they haven't been hit in the face with it yet. Where when you're a little later in your career, you know, you're a little battered and bruised and you kind of understand that the systemic barriers you're facing or some of the bias that you're facing, and so coming together to discuss it is more meaningful to you. So I can say anecdotally, we've definitely seen, you know, younger women just sometimes aren't quite there yet. They come out of university where they're killing it, typically, and then into the workplace a little bit more optimistic than, you know, I think women in their 30s and 40s and 50s are.
That's similar to my anecdotal experience. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah.
A colleague of mine was recently going to speak at a college in Utah, and the it was a women's conference, and the students submitted questions beforehand, and she had, I think we counted, 6 out of, you know, 20 questions that were essentially along the lines of, don't you think Me Too has just made things worse? And it was one of those things where we were like, is this Utah? Like, is this generation? Like, what's going on? And you know, I have to, I have to grant them their premise that from their perspective in the short lives that they have lived, things seemed okay, and then things seemed really bad. And right, and so it's you have to understand that that is a valid perspective, and then you know as we continue to talk about these topics, have these difficult conversations, people's awareness will change, and it may change in one direction or another, but it will change.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, hi, I'm Kristen. Just my personal story. I didn't know until my 40s. When I look back and I'm like, oh my God, that could have gone so much better, right? So I totally agree. And then what was the quote Gloria Steinem said this morning about freeing the slaves? I could have freed more if they knew they were slaves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think there's some of that, you know, as well. They'll figure it out. Give them 10 years in corporate America. So the one of the points I wanted to make too, I know this is like a business conference, but what has worked for me as far as confronting privilege is talking about it at home. So it seemed a lot less daunting than calling it out at work, right? Or having a one-on-one with someone at work. So, I happen to be married to a straight white male, he's a CFO. So, he kind of fits the bill of privilege. And, I don't expect him to go to the women's marches with me. I don't expect him to wear my Black Lives Matter, t-shirt. But I tell him we'll get there. But what I've just started is I've just asked him when he goes into the office, and this goes back to that having the male allies, his first task I gave him was just listen. When you're in a meeting, just listen. Are the women getting talked over? Is someone validating their point, or is someone stealing that idea, and then voicing it themselves? So that, and then he's also, in charge of a lot of the hiring decisions. And so he'll say, well, they only gave me resumes for white men. What can I do? And I said, what you do is you call your recruiter and you say, send me another batch of resumes. And this time I want them to reflect, diversity, both in gender and, all of that. So he was like, talk about woke, right? Until we have that conversation. So I kind of saw that as like my sly way into a tech company, because I'm like, I can help him, from the inside. So my question for the panel is on, it's actually the title, I think, of the panel is like, basically moving forward, but like you mentioned, like why men are so afraid right now. And I loved that you said, unless you're a serial rapist, like what are you worried about, right? But I really do wonder what they're worried about. So is that in the research? Do they actually say like, I'm afraid I'll want to have sex with her, or I'm afraid she'll attack me, or I'm afraid, like what do they think is going to happen at a business dinner, and I'm serious, like, what does the research say? And then, but then to that point, I also, and you can tell me honestly, are they afraid of being falsely accused? Like, is there this, and because that's another whole conversation, right, with our Supreme Court justice and everything that this country just saw very publicly. So is that it? Are they just, I'll let you answer.
Where to begin?
Yeah. Tell us about men's fears.
Yeah. So one, the let's just hit the false narrative first. And it is a false narrative, and the evidence does prove this, right? So there is this amongst men that we hear this all the time that, the concern is, and again, much like played out in the public on TV and the media, with the Supreme Court justice hearings, that there's women are out there to falsely, accuse men of harassment or rape or whatever the case might be, right? The research does not show that.
No, it is
a small, insignificant number of fault. There are some false claims, but there's such a small number. But
and the number of the incidents that are not reported is
the other half of it, right?
So much bigger.
Yeah,
so
it's the most underreported crime, right? And so it's just, there is such a false narrative to it that tends to become myth and lore amongst men. that becomes part of the justification. I think there's a larger conversation out there that we need to have as well about that men need to think about, again, owning and understanding themselves about why they're, again, maybe reluctant to have these relationships at work or to whatever the case might be. And part of it is some anxiety, right? That men do have some anxiety about having a professional relationship with a woman at work. And it's interesting, you know, I do this with my military students. It's funny, I won't just say professional relationship, I'll say an intimate professional relationship. And they're just like, they start to cringe. They're like, he said intimate, oh my God. We're gonna talk about intimacy in the classroom? I'm like, yes, we're gonna talk about intimacy. And he's like, and their idea of what that means, right, is something very different. But it's like, no, you're gonna have a close personal relationship with this person at work, and it's okay. And what we find is that a lot of guys don't have what we would call kind of like a social script to follow necessarily, right? Because you think about it, as we raise our young men at home, the boys, that I look back and I go, you know, I had a social script. I was socialized on how to have a relationship with my mom. I have one for my sister. I have one today for my wife. And yes, I do have a daughter, disclaimer. And I think I have a great relationship with her. But again, I was given that script, right? I was taught what that looked like and sounded like. But for having a professional relationship with a woman at work, that happened after I left the house, right? After I was into my career. And some guys get a little anxious about that. And what do we do when we're anxious? We avoid. We move away from it, right? And so that's what you see, this reluctancy. But, you know, as we talked about, the only solution to that really is from a psychological perspective, is exposure therapy, right? So, you know, more interactions, more coffees, more lunches, more together talking about some of these issues and getting comfortable having those conversations is part of it. The other part is perceptions, right? And this comes up all the time with men that we have. And it's not just men. Women talk about this too, especially as we get to mentoring relationships. What is it, you know, suddenly if this man and this maybe a senior man and a more junior woman start spending a lot of time together, what's going on there? You know, what could it be? Might be this, it might be that. And so men definitely talk about that, and they're thinking about that, right, in particular. And so we have to address that, or what will my partner, my spouse say if I suddenly start spending all this time with this junior woman at work? People are gonna, you know, there might be some concerns there, and how do we overcome some of that? And I think there's, again, a lot of great ideas that we talk about in Athena Rising about, hey, you just need to be very transparent about what you're doing, right, and be very intentional and deliberate about it. But the transparency piece, I think, is really important about where you meet, the when you meet. And the fact that if you suddenly have been mentoring men your entire career and now you suddenly start to mentor this one junior woman, yeah, it might look a little off to everybody, right? But you know what? If I mentor lots of men, and I mentor lots of women too, nobody's going to talk about that. Right? That's just what we do. And that's what we need to get to. We need to get to that point that we recognize talent for what talent is, right? And that we're helping to develop that. But I think it's a great question. There's this narrative out there that we have to, again, we have to engage men and have this conversation about what they think might be going on or not going on.
And one of the things we talked about yesterday was just how do we push into the narrative the benefits as well of getting this right. So, you know, we all know a lot of the research, or I hope we do, but, you know, if there's more women in organizations, the incidence of sexual harassment is lower. If there's more women in leadership, companies tend to have better employee policies, friendlier employee policies, and business results tend to be better. We know on diverse teams, people on diverse teams are more committed and often work harder. And if you're a manager, a man or a woman, or any gender, if you work well with everybody on your team, you're going to be more effective and you're likely going to excel. So I think that's a big message. You know, the what's in it for me, for men, is tapping the full talents of your team and being the best manager you can be and getting noticed for that. And so I do think pushing out the overall benefits for diversity and inclusion in the organization and making sure that's a big part of the narrative, and then the what's in it for me is equally as important.
One last thing. The point you... the story you raised about with your husband, and I can't say this enough, and I'm not being flippant about it, but we have got to start. If we're going to fix the workplace, the way forward is not necessarily to start in the workplace. The way to start is at home, right? And so the message to guys is do the dishes, right? Take the kids to childcare. Take the kids to the doctor, right? Be a 50-50 partner at home, and then you'll be a 50-50 partner at work. That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
They still call me, but now they call him first. And I was like,
But as you acknowledge power, you know, there's a lot of that starts at home in the family, right? Yeah. And so we have got to acknowledge that and start doing it at home first.
Especially if you're raising a son and a daughter. So I'm yeah.
Exactly.
And the other thing I like to point out, my husband now doesn't want to watch TV with me anymore because we'll wait till the end of the episode and then I'll say, look, a man wrote that. Look, a man directed that. And then I'll be like, so then we go back and talk about the storyline. And I say, do you see that entire storyline was from the man's perspective? A woman wouldn't act like that. You know, the actress, yes, she's delivering the lines, but the writer was a male, the director was a male, the producer was a male. So it's so pervasive in everything we experience. At home, at work, and society.
Absolutely. So I think we only have time for one or two more questions. I'm so sorry.
My name's Laura. I'm a recruiter in life sciences, and every time my customer asks me for a diverse slate of candidates, they get one, just so you know.
Yeah.
But I feel like in this Me Too era, I think it's really hard for women and men. I think we both don't know exactly what our roles are or what we're supposed to say or how we're supposed to act, so I really enjoy this dialogue. I'd really like somebody to come up with a playbook, so if anybody wants to put one together, I'm in. And that's all I really wanted to say. I think it's, for men, you know, work for them is a lot like sports, so if you gave them, like, the playbook and this is what it looks like and you do this play and then you get this result, I think if we can get it down to that, what I struggle with at work, honestly, is that I quit doing dinners with my clients a long time ago because that became very uncomfortable several times. And I said, I'm not doing that anymore. I'm just have lunch or coffee. But I feel like men just don't know how to be friends with women. I feel like there's not a real good, unless they were socialized that way, young and brought up, I think they just really struggle having that friendship relationship. And so, I'm a friends first kind of gal in all my relationships, men, women, it doesn't matter. So I feel like I have to take the lead and show them what it's like to be a good friend and put the brakes on when I feel like it's a little uncomfortable for me and explain why it's uncomfortable and say it's not, I know you're not intending to do that, but you just parented me. You just did this. You just made me feel like I was five. And I really don't like it. And a couple other times, it hasn't been a pleasant on the other side, like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm like, look, just take it for feedback. I didn't mean it to be mean or anything, but you have to become more aware.
Yeah, one of my favorite things that Dave and Brad talk about is reminding men that they have a prefrontal cortex. So you can be friends with a woman. You can be attracted to her, even, and not act on it. That's why we have the prefrontal cortex.
And it's interesting, right?
I'm going to use that.
Yeah. It's all Dave and Brad.
Yeah, so the whole attraction thing is part of it, right? And this is why guys, again, if we think about this, right, that because we tend to sexualize relationships with women. And so if you feel that attraction, there's always that possibility. Men think about this a lot, that there's always that possibility if you have a friendship with a woman that you might be attracted to her. And then what happens? Guys will do a few things. One, they just get really uncomfortable with it, and they're gone, right? They're out of the picture. It's like, what happened?
That's not my experience.
Yeah. Or they come back, and they go, oh, well, what should we do about this? You know, I'm kind of attracted to you.
How about nothing?
Yeah, right.
is anyone else thinking of When Harry Met Sally?
Yeah. I want to make sure we can answer your question before we have to wrap.
Okay, I'll make it quick. And I think it goes to the issue of the keynote speaker talking about with courage comes vulnerability leads to courage. And it also goes to, I think, not just on an individual level for a person, but also on a corporate level. When mistakes happen, when an incident happens, and you have to apologize, an apology is called for. Nothing makes me less interested in the apology than, I'm so sorry. That's not who I am.
I'm sorry, was that your evil twin that just did something? Because it is you who did it. So would you please own it and rephrase it as, that's not who I want to be. That's not how I was raised to be. It was a mistake. I will do better. I have so much more respect for that kind of an apology other than the, I'm sorry, let me distance myself from my apology by saying, that's not who I am. I don't think that works on an individual level or on a corporate level.
Right. And to Wendy's point about grace, I think preceding grace has to be an apology.
Yes, of course.
Right? And has to be a genuine apology.
I'm open to that. I'm the sort of person, you show me an inch of an actual ownership, and I'll give you all the forgiveness you want. Mm-hmm.
Did you want to sneak yours in? Yeah, I know you've been standing there.
Hi, I have a question in the form of a question. So I love to ditch the bad language. So we know like flexibility is a bad word, and we replace it with autonomy. We learned that in research. We know that bias can trigger, but if we use things like neuroscience and fast thinking, Nobel economists, then it works. Any other really quick hacks? What language to let go, what to replace it with? Thanks.
Well, I have one that I, just in general, in difficult conversations, when you write a book about conflict, you get to hear a lot of interesting stories from people about conflicts. And one of my favorites is, they'll tell me the story and they'll go, don't you think that's inappropriate? I'm like, well, inappropriate really is a like subjective term. And that's one of the things, right? I think instead of saying that was completely inappropriate, you want to be specific about what is the impact of the behavior you are labeling inappropriate and acknowledge that the person perpetuating that behavior probably doesn't think it's inappropriate or doesn't know it's inappropriate sometimes. That's one of the ones that I think you just want to be specific about. Instead of being like, that's inappropriate, she's, you know, whatever it is, saying when that person did that, this was the potential impact on the people around them.
And one of the things we know, and of course we've been using this vernacular, right? We've been using bias, but if you switch the conversation more towards equality, most people will get on board with the idea of equality if you kind of frame it as, yes, right, as a positive, as opposed to anchoring on some of the, you know, negative vernacular around the issues. We do know there's research there.
You're being unfair. You're being mean-spirited. I think those words transcend, you know, gender bias, but they still get to the point.
Everybody, I think that's all the time we have. I'm not going to get up and use the microphone. Everyone can hear me, right? So, just a little plug. I think Dave and Amy are both signing books right after this. So, if you want to go get their books or a book to be ordered, I think they're available to do that. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you.